This is Laura Waterman, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona, reading science fiction. Today we start with a story from the October 1985 issue of the magazine of fantasy and science fiction. This is As Duly Authorized by Fred Saberhagen. The truth of our late 21st century lives is contained in our documents, our filmed and magnetized records, or so we believe. Therefore, not only my own life, but the foundation of all our lives is now at stake. For the sake of our whole world's survival, it is vital that this statement of mine be credited, that appropriate action, in this case, an investigation of the monstrous child, Martin Mandel, be taken without delay by those authorized to do so. It was this child, Martin Mandel, who on a day some 3 weeks ago began the chain of events that has brought me to my present unhappy situation. I was then, and had been for about 2 years, assigned to the Bureau of Science, Department of Paleontology, Fairbanks office. My duties were, of course, administrative and commensurate with my rank. Nearly a score of clerks and aides worked under my direction. That never-to-be-forgotten day began like any other and continued so until mid-afternoon. At that time, I was slightly irritated to notice that my then-secretary, Ms. Lorraine Mandel, the child's widowed mother, had already spent several minutes of working time in the corridor outside my office, engaged in a personal conversation with the technician, Antonelli. Antonelli had paused for this discussion while transporting through the corridor a paleontological fieldwork robot, while the technician allowed his attention to be distracted from his duties regarding this device, the Mandel child approached down the corridor. It was the child's custom, despite my continued efforts to discourage the practice, to pass the office each day on his way home from school and from the corridor, distract his mother at least momentarily from her duties. Today, most of the width of the corridor was occupied by the fieldwork robot, standing waiting while Antonelli chatted. Whether from sheer idle curiosity or from some yet baser motive, young Mandel was attracted to the controls of the machine. Before anyone was aware of the danger, it had begun to labor, and before Antonelli could regain control of the device, it had bored sizable openings, several centimeters in diameter, in both sides of the corridor, in completely unauthorized locations. Since one of these openings pierced the external wall of the building complex, and the other, almost directly opposite, breached the window between my office and the corridor, my staff and I were at once engulfed in a rush of raw outside air. In passing, I may remark, that the technician's lapse and the boy's mischief, if it was no more than mischief, would certainly have had a much severer effect had the incident occurred during the winter months. Since we here in Alaska are, as you probably know, in the high northern latitudes, a direct opening of the building in January, say, would have admitted a volume of air at such low temperatures as to be immediately dangerous to health, air perhaps accompanied by frozen precipitation, all forms of which, I am sure, are highly unpleasant. Too late, Lorraine seized upon her son, who began to howl. He is, I suppose, 6 or 8 years of age, and of what I should call nondescript appearance, save for the small permanent vertical crease in his forehead that gives to his face the expression of a habitual frown. I gave Lorraine leave to remove the child to home or playground or wherever he should have been at that time of day, and then I turned to Antonelli. "Nobody's hurt, thank God. Nobody's hurt," was all that he could find to say at first. "Fortunately for you," I replied. From the bookcase beside my desk, I brushed fine fragments of window glass and pulled out Volume 1 of the Emergency Reporting Procedures, which I keep available at all times in non-electronic form to be prepared for power failures. I weighed the book significantly in my hand and opened it. However, if memory serves me correctly, yes, here is the appropriate section. Even when no personal injury is involved, there are 17 separate reports to be filled out following an accident of this type involving the destruction of property. You are undoubtedly the one responsible. The reports are to be completed at once before you resume your normal duties. 17, he mumbled, shocked. He looked at his watch. Sir, I am responsible. I'll pay for the damage, of course. But right now I can't sit down and make out 17 forms. Some must be long ones. Naturally. You see, I have to get this robot out to the diggings in just an hour. We're short of techs, and there's no one else I can ask to handle it. I accept responsibility for what happened if we can just let some of these reports go until I hurry back. That is quite impossible. The World Office regulations are very clear on the procedure to be followed. Maybe you don't understand, sir, but it's vital for me to get out there inside of an hour. If I miss this digging today, maybe even my whole future career will be shot. I was just telling Lorraine here about this one opening in scientist grade one. Although I had given Lorraine leave to remove her child, she was still hovering nearby. Her arms were around her son, who clung to her. I recall now, and now shudder at the possible significance of the fact, that he was chewing like an infant on some small, already half-demolished plastic toy, while his eyes stared up at me from under his frowning forehead. His mother's eyes were also fixed on mine, and they held a pleading expression I had not seen in them before. "Oh, really, it was my fault. Marty's my responsibility. Tony here isn't to blame." "In this case, Lorraine," I said to her, "your sympathy is misplaced. Please remove the child to wherever his proper location at this hour may be." After another moment, she nodded reluctantly and turned away with her offspring. I then, with a sigh, turned back to face Antonelli and my unpleasant task of seeing to it that the culprit complied with regulations. I regretted that the danger to the technician's future career was probably real. In the Bureau of Science, many of even the higher positions of authority are filled by persons known more for their technical ability than their administrative competence, so that his hope for advancement was not altogether illusory. It is also true that the Department of Paleontology's circumpolar aberrations, due to the shortness of the annual period of summer weather and thawed-out soil, operational schedules are frequently rigid, and the junior worker who misses his chance for fieldwork on one day may not be granted another chance on the next. These operational difficulties and the need for haste arising therefrom are used by some to justify all manner of procedural irregularities. Irregularity has never been the rule in my office. The regulations on reporting accidents were perfectly clear, and I was, of course, prepared to call the police, if need be, to enforce them. I made sure that Antonelli was aware of this fact. As there was then nothing else that he could do, he seated himself at Lorraine's desk. Helpfully, I placed a micro writer several rolls of blank magnetic film and the book of emergency reporting procedures containing blanks of all the necessary forms before him. He opened the volume with an air of hopelessness, but soon he raised his fingers to the keyboard of the microwriter and began furiously to type. I remember feeling a pang of sympathy for him, as it was manifestly impossible that the most skilled clerk should be able to complete the 17 forms in less than half a day. It had become apparent to my olfactory sense that some spice-like pollen or similar substance was entering the room from outside, through the holes in wall and window, but I still had duties to perform, cautioning my staff against unnecessary deep breathing of this unauthorized air. I returned to my own desk and on my personal microwriter began the reports that would be required of me as senior administrator at the scene of the accident. This had occupied me for some 20 minutes when, raising my head, I saw that Lorraine had returned to the office. Her apartment on the residential level was only a minute's walk away. She was standing now beside her own desk, at which Antonelli was still seated and speaking earnestly to him. As I watched, she nervously and, as I thought, furtively, placed her right hand briefly in his. The manner in which this was done suggested to me very strongly that she had secretly given him some small object or objects. I gave no sign of having observed anything out of the ordinary. I waited, and as may well be imagined, I wondered. Lorraine, though her desk had been preempted, attempted to resume some of her normal duties about the office. She also coordinated the efforts of the maintenance engineer, who had at last arrived to sweep up the debris of the accident and who, on the completion of my written request, arranged temporary coverings for the holes. Scarcely a minute after she had passed some object to him, Antonelli hurried over to me. "Sir, here are the reports you need." He gave the impression of a man almost strangling with relief. "If there's anything else, I'll be back as soon as I can." He bolted from the office, and an instant later I heard the heavy, soft treads of the robot moving away. With a heavy heart, I slid the film Antonelli had given me into my viewer. To my amazement, it held what appeared to be a sequence of 17 genuine accident reports, each differing from the others in detail, all of them acceptably filled out. Each described the accident as it had taken place, including the serial numbers of the equipment involved, the contractors and all subcontractors for both the robot and the building, and where necessary, with appropriate background material as Antonelli's family information, etc. For a minute or two, I sat staring into the viewer. Of course, the film could not have been honestly produced in 20 minutes. I looked towards Lorraine, but she was avoiding my eye. Sadly, I allowed myself to be almost completely convinced that she was implicated in the loathsome crime of computerized forgery, evidently involving some totally unauthorized tap-in on and time theft from some computer of awesome capability. How could I have imagined then what the truth involved, an even more monstrous evil, one that might threaten the foundations of our civilization? Even though the true horror of the situation had not yet dawned upon me, still, as Lorraine's superior, I naturally felt some concern and responsibility towards her. Damning as the evidence of computer crime appeared to be, I still wanted to give her every benefit of the doubt before initiating a formal investigation. It was this concern that caused me to take measures to overhear her conversation that evening with Antonelli in the local dining room. That evening I went alone, as usual, to dine. Looking about the large room before choosing a table, I noticed my secretary and the technician in animated conversation at a somewhat isolated table located beside the artificial waterfall and its decorative shrubbery, making a circuitous approach so they would remain unaware of my nearness. I chose for myself a table separated from theirs only by the dense foliage of the shrubs. The waterfall masked other sounds. I drew from my pocket my small listening aid, a valuable tool I carried for the purpose of evaluation of subordinates in the office, and unobtrusively focused it in their direction. To my surprise, Lorraine was questioning the would-be scientist about evolution, mutation, and related subjects. I recorded much of the conversation and replayed it alone in my study later that night, so it is fixed quite firmly in my memory. Antonelli, in the expansive manner of a fool in the advanced stages of infatuation, was eager to display his knowledge by giving extensive answers to Lorraine's questions. Her particular interest seemed to be in what I understand is now called punctuationalism, the field of knowledge concerning sudden evolutionary change. Antonelli spoke of her of the bat and the whale, both appearing suddenly in early tertiary times, both in their earliest known forms already fully adapted for their highly specialized modes of life. He mentioned Arsinoetherium, the strange ungulate of Oligocene Egypt that seems to be totally without immediate ancestors or descendants of any kind. He waxed excited over the peppered moth, a species saved from extinction by a black mutation coming at just the right time to preserve its camouflage when the surfaces of its city environment were being darkened by the fumes of the Industrial Revolution. I recall now with special clarity one other sentence from his lecture. The theory seems to be firmly established now that since the arrival of Homo sapiens on the scene, evolutionary pressure has dropped off in the other species. The torch seems to be ours to bear. Aha, breathed Lorraine, leaning back in her chair so that now I could glimpse her face between branches of shrubbery. Antonelli's last remark seemed to have struck her with peculiar force. He soon began a clumsy attempt to woo her. She, who had evaded my own least attempts at friendliness, did not laugh at the technician or coldly rebuff him at once, as a day earlier I should have thought inevitable. Instead, a thoughtful silence ensued, followed by these words in Lorraine's voice. Tony, before I can let myself get serious about any man, I have to be very sure about him. I'm in a special situation with Marty. You can't understand it yet. Sure I can. The kid needs a father. Oh, I know, but there's more to it than that. In Marty's case, there are strains. Marty's father was under great emotional stress when he died in that accident. Well, I'm sure that wasn't your fault, and it wasn't the kid's. Now, was it? No. So the little guy flipped a switch on my machine. You got me out of trouble. I won't ask how you managed to produce those films, but kids do things like that. It doesn't mean he's a monster or anything. There was a silence. Lorraine had leaned forward again, and I could no longer see her face. Then Antonelli's voice again. What is it? What's the matter? Nothing. I'm all right. Listen, Lorraine, whatever troubles you've got, I want you to know you can trust me and tell me about them. I want to believe that, Tony. And there was silence again, lasting for a considerable time. As I sat there, I realized fully how extravagant were the fallacies with which I had lately beguiled some of my leisure moments, daydreams that had involved Lorraine. Before the revelation of that day, I had sometimes even imagined the two of us obtaining and processing betrothal and marriage contracts. I had envisioned her name beside mine in the spaces of those forms. I now saw clearly, I say, how foolish such fancies were. Yet there remained to me my duty as Lorraine's superior to do what I could for her in the way of ethical and legal counseling. Concern for her son was also in my thoughts. I considered that forgery and loose romantic dalliance formed an unsuitable environment for a child's proper development. I kept my own counsel until the close of office hours on the next day. Then I calmly stated to Lorraine that, with her permission, I intended to call upon her in her home that evening. There were, I told her, certain matters of the greatest importance that I felt we must privately discuss without delay. An unmistakable expression of guilty fear appeared in her eyes, but she did not dare refuse so reasonable a request. When I presented myself that evening at the door of Lorraine's apartment, she admitted me readily enough. She was attempting to conceal her guilty fear, but to my eyes it was still evident. "We are alone?" I asked. "Yes, I've sent Marty next door for a while. What is it that you want?" After giving her to understand that she lay under a cloud of the gravest suspicions of computerized forgery, I tried to discuss with her in a paternal way what course of action she might honorably take to extricate herself. She deliberately misunderstood my motives and declaimed, "How could I ever have thought you were a friend? You had better allow me to be your friend, Lorraine. Considering your unfortunate situation at present, you would be wise to accept the counsel of a man of acknowledged judgment and influence, particularly to salvage what chance there may be still for you to retain custody of your child." She gasped, struggling to maintain her air of innocence, and continued deliberately to misunderstand. "I never imagined that you could stoop so low." I placed my hand on her arm, intended only to reassure her that my intentions were entirely honorable. At this, she physically attacked me, leaving scratches on my face and arms that subsequently required medical treatment. In endeavoring to protect myself, I may have unintentionally tripped her. I am, of course, not accustomed to such encounters, and am ignorant of the precise degree of force needed to ward off the attack of a hysterical woman. Whatever bruises may have appeared later on her face must have been caused by her striking the floor or some item of furniture in her fall. The same for her torn dress, etc. The child, who had evidently been eavesdropping somewhere nearby, now ran in shrieking. In my understandable excitement, I may have made some move towards him that could momentarily have been interpreted as threatening. He screamed as if in terror and cowered away from me. His foolish mother flew to the howling boy at once, meanwhile berating me in terms that I prefer not to dignify in print. Maintaining my composure as best I could, with my own blood dripping from the wounds on my face, I proceeded calmly across the room to the communicator. It was clear to me at last that the woman had no intention of trying to save herself from her own folly. Only one course of action remained open to me as a good citizen. When she saw what I was doing, the woman's bravado collapsed. "Whom are you calling?" "I'm afraid I must call the police." The words struck terror to her guilty heart. She crossed the room to my side, cringing and pleading. I know now what monstrous thing she was concealing from the world, but then, though I had already initiated the call, the natural mercy of my heart was touched, and I hesitated, as so did my eyes were drawn to the child by the sudden cessation of his yells. He stood facing me, feet planted wide apart, fists clenched, a scowl of utter malevolence upon his face. I can only describe his attitude as that of a ruffian about to hurl a missile or fire a gun. Let me set down baldly what I next saw. From the vertical crease in the center of the boy's forehead, there began to emerge the squared corners of a small and very thin object. I stood watching, completely stunned. I faintly recall some policeman's voice coming from the communicator that I still held, but I was too stupefied to answer. I suppose I must have broken the connection. Lorraine had fallen silent. The emergence of magnetic computer film from her son's skull was no surprise to her. I could see that, but she was terrified that I should have seen it happen. She ran to the child, but her clutching fingers were too late to conceal the event. She was only in time to catch the square of film as it fell, fully extruded from the center of the child's forehead. Only this familiar permanent frown crease was left as a visible hint of abnormality. Before Lorraine's hand closed on the film, I was able to see upon it the familiar pattern of tiny rectangles showing that it bore a set of miniaturized documents. In a flash, I realized that the police would find in this apartment no common computer pirate's terminals or other electronic gear, and I understood Lorraine's deep interest in evolution and mutation. I even understood with horror the monstrous child's chewing on plastic toys. No doubt his metabolism requires some such bizarre nourishment to produce film by organic means. The knowledge that I had become privy to her hideous secret and could be expected to inform the proper authorities at once, completely overwhelmed with dread, the wretched woman's heart. "Please," she whined, "I'll do anything you say, only don't tell. They'll take my son and make a freak out of him. He'll live like an animal in a cage for the rest of his life. Please, he's never made a film to harm anyone." I recoiled with loathing from her clutching hands. Had I wanted to reply to her absurd request, I could not have done so, being only dumb with shock. Only when the police, impelled to haste by the broken communication, burst into the apartment, did I regain the power of speech. I pointed with a shaking finger. "There, officers, that film in the woman's hand. Seize it and examine it, and then I will tell you where it came from." The officer in charge took the film from Lorraine's unresisting finger. He inspected it for some moments with his pocket viewer, then raised his eyes to me. "And your name is?" I told him my name. He nodded briskly to his cohort, and in an instant, my arms were brutally pinioned behind my back. "Careful with him, boys. These records from the nut house say he's dangerous. Did he hurt you much, lady?" I struggled to explain the truth. Under the circumstances, is it strange that I was rather incoherent? "No. You don't need to tell me where the records came from, mister. I've seen 1,000 of 'em. March him out careful. The truth of our lives is contained in our filmed and magnetized computer records, or so we believe. With the flawless film before them, neither police nor doctors gave me more than a cursory examination or heeded any of my protests. Judging from the size of the ward in which I find myself, the doctors whose signatures appear forged on my commitment record may well certify dozens of persons each month. Perhaps when they see me, they are surprised not to remember my case. Perhaps they sometimes puzzle over the absence of relevant records in their own files. But no one doubts the single set of medical records that do exist. There is a theory that the direction of evolutionary change is determined by the psychology of the species concerned. That long teeth were grown by the first tigers because those animals possessed the souls of carnivores. What the Mandel boy possesses, or what possesses him, I do not know. I am perfectly sure that the printing, the magnetic codes, the microtyping, the signatures, all so perfectly simulated upon the perfect films that form inside his skull, all these can be no result of detailed conscious thought or effort on his part, some genetic response instead to the environment in which he lives. I insist that I am sane and innocent. What I have recorded here is the truth. I beg anyone in authority who may read this document, begin an investigation of the monstrous child at once. I plead not only for my own sake, but for our world's survival. Investigate the child, Martin Mandel, at once, before it is too late. We continue with a story from the December 1985 issue of the magazine of fantasy and science fiction. This is Fear of Flying by Hal Hill. The jumbo jet was cruising just a few feet below outer space at a speed that would whip your eyeballs out when the tip of the right wing tore off. Many's the time I'd seen it on TV, dead, still faces peering through the thick glass portals as nightmares of engine failure and structural collapse. Shit, I'd say, they're in trouble, past the chips. Watching on TV is safer, of course, but you miss the sudden cold sweat and the low voltage paralysis that makes an idiot of you for those few seconds. The airliner pitched to the right before any of us that saw could speak. Slow motion thunder rumbled through the aluminum shell of the plane. I heard the throttle increase as the captain righted her, then tilted slightly to the left. There was some vibration, but the craft seemed to be holding steady in a lopsided sort of way. Then the fasten your seatbelt blinked on, and the juxtaposition of the flashing signs and a cabinet littered with people tossed from their seats was ludicrous, and I remember laughing. Most of my fellow passengers in second class weren't laughing, however. Some were frozen in the pre-stages of panic, hyperventilating themselves into a swoon in preparation for the hard few minutes ahead. Two elderly ladies in seats across the aisle held hands, then lay back in the bland blonde recliners and closed their eyes. All around me, the ranting and reasoning started up, a chattering din of importuning and admonitions that defined for me once and for all the word babble. In the seat behind me, a woman of weasel build and weasel disposition screamed in a cutting Swedish steel voice. Outside, the portal, the world, wheeled by in clear blue, still miles above the milky film of clouds that marked the boundary between the plain and the lakes and rocks and hard-packed earth of terra firma. There was still the occasional bump or thump, but my traveling companions were beginning to redeposit themselves in their seats, checking for bruises and breaks, and perhaps thinking of their lawyers in that precious time. Then came the voice from the speakers. "Ladies and gentlemen, this is the captain speaking. Please remain seated and keep your seatbelts fastened." His voice was an alpine lake, clear, calm, and totally out of place in the shambles of the cabin. Stewardesses were straightening their funny caps and were helping people back into their seats. A gentleman in tweed and a tidy fox-hunting mustache thought he'd broken his arm, but he wasn't sure. "We have sustained some minor structural damage, but the plane is responding well to the situation. Part of the right wing has ripped off, the weasel woman shrieked. The passengers on the left side of the aisle looked aghast at us on the right, as if we had crawled out on the wing and torn a portion off. Their wing was fine. What was wrong with ours? We will be landing at the first available runway, the captain finished. He had given it to us straight, because that's the way Americans want it. We want the truth, want a chance to fear the worst, then buck up and kick its ass. Everyone was wearing their cocktails now, so the cabin reeked of liquor. I thought of those frail kindred souls that had earlier gathered in the bar to try and drink away their fear of flying, strapped in their lounge chairs now, ordering more scotch, calling for gallons, hogsheads of drink, to dispel the new fear of death, the dark, dry grandmama of fear of flying. Sterile plastic nose masks suspended by clear poly tubes suddenly dangled from apartments above our heads. An army of formless fake spiders come to save us. A stewardess of apparent Nordic lineage began explaining how to use the breathing devices in case of emergency. The lines of her face were straight and clean, perfect for soap commercials and for telling ethnic types like myself to take a hike. She slipped the elastic around her head, the mask over her pert nose, and I watched the pristine fog form on the clear plastic as she talked. This is only a precautionary device, of course, to be used in the unlikely event of cabin depressurization. She smiled blankly through the recitation, going on in a Girl Scout cookie voice about the benefits of oxygen, while her grim-faced audience shared black visions of wing collapse. Having blocked out the surrounding reality entirely, she was able to function, thus demonstrating succinctly the sometimes advantage of living the unexamined life to the hilt. I heard a loud crack like the report of a hunting rifle outside the portal. The plane pitched to the right, and I watched the stewardess fly into the open doorway of the food cupboard. Those occupying seats on the far side of the plane rose to a sharp angle, their arms flailing like rag dolls caught on a berserk carnival ride. It was then that I understood that I might soon die. And that is when I left. I found myself looking down into the cabin from one of the dome lights mounted in the ceiling above the center aisle, a cool witness to the desperate jumble below. I squatted cross-legged in the light and could feel the captain fighting to regain control of the machine. I watched my side of the teeter-tottering cabin rise and myself with it, as the power to the engines on the ruptured wing was increased to compensate. My side of the cabin rose roughly 15 degrees shy of level, and the plane steadied itself into a circular course, like a clipper ship caught in the upper reaches of a whirlpool. Not everyone was screaming, probably only 30% to 40%, but theirs were the ghastly serpentine moans of a dying jumbo jet. When I was a 5-year-old, I slipped into the icy water of a frozen lake and drowned, as they say. I was dead for almost 10 minutes, and it took me nearly 5 years to regain those early social skills, such as feeding myself, talking, and pottying in the correct place. I was left with no memory of the experience, no prescient image, no mutant psychic or mental capabilities whatsoever. I can only suggest in retrospect that that episode was a sort of preparation for the plane ride. As we stare into the face of the worst possible danger, the primal instincts take over and we must choose fight or flight. But in certain situations, for example, plummeting jetliners, sharks, and nuclear war, these two options are withdrawn just when you need them most. The out-of-body experience was the only place to run, to hide, and let a cooler, more ectoplasmic head prevail. That analog I had no fear of death, recalling perhaps that I had died before. The Viking stewardess was making her way down the aisle towards my section. She hobbled along at a tilt, groping from one armrest to the next. The tableau reminded me of the mystery spots my family had visited when I was a child. Each had a slanted room where water appeared to run uphill, cockily defying the frail laws of gravity. And now, if the earth would only rush away from the plane as it approached. The stewardess reached across the two empty seats next to me and pressed my arm. At her touch, my Dr. Strange self winked out, and I found myself looking across at a nasty bruise the attendant had sustained on her left cheek. Out the portal, I could see that a section of the jet's aluminum skin had peeled off, exposing a top portion of the wing, and perhaps just a bit more of the wing had been nipped off with it. My newfound rapture remained unsullied by my return to the baleful predicament, however. I still felt here, there, and everywhere the mark of the mouse, as I recall. Mr. Karras? Yes. Could you please come with me? The captain would like to speak with you. I wore a giddy imitation of Buddha's smile as I moved through the lounge and first-class sections, an inscrutable near grin that easily told anyone who cared to look that I was vaguely insane. All the range of anguish showed on the faces I passed, and forlornness, and eyes lost in reflection of lost changes, loved ones, and lapsed insurance policies. I felt like Dante being led through another level of the inferno, this one the hell of falling from the sky. I entered the spacious cockpit and watched the captain tag the co-pilot, leaving the junior officer to wrestle with the jet's jumbo spasms. Mr. Eisenhower Karras? He shook my hand. I'm Ed Burke. Why don't we have a seat here? He said, indicating two molded plastic chairs and a small round cocktail table. Like myself, the captain was short. He had a bearish build and thick Slavic features. The storm that raged in the hearts of his passengers lay becalmed in his placid gray eyes, and he wore my smile. He was simpatico, ready to live or die, live and die, or whatever. He winked at me as we sat, saying, "Your folks must have liked Ike, huh? A golfer for his time," I quipped. We laughed. "The reason I've asked you up here, Ike, can I call you Ike, is that we're having some trouble with the plane." He seemed almost to giggle at his understatement then, but checked himself. If his reaction seems strange now, it's because he was under an incredible amount of stress, as we all surely were. We weren't living men trying to thwart death, but dead men playing at a game of life. "I may have to call on your help if things get worse." He placed his elbows on the formica tabletop, waiting for my answer. The droll notion that anything could be done if conditions worsened was framed in a serious way, so I put on a serious face. "You can count on me, Ed," I heard myself saying. At the time, it didn't cross my mind to ask him why in the world he would wish to count on me. I am a swarthy Mediterranean type of uncertain ancestry, then nearing my 35th birthday. I was a stand-up comic, still trying to struggle out of the lounges into the main act. I had an ex-wife who still enjoyed crossing me long distance, a girlfriend hooked on awareness seminars, and a dwindling set of Melmac dishes with cigarette burns on them. I thought of the only airplane joke I knew. If things went from bad to worse, I could always advise my fellow passengers to bend over, put their heads between their legs, and kiss their sweet asses goodbye. Surely that wasn't what Ed Burke was after. "That's great," Ed said. giving me a bearish cuff on the shoulder, because I can't think of a better person than a man of the cloth to lead people through what I have in mind. My stalwart vinyl face faltered then, its oaken lines scuttled in a wash of confusion. Then I remembered I had signed on as a minister. I was a minister, having recently shelled out $2 to become a minor prelate in the Universal Life Church. I was taking the plane to Flagstaff, Arizona, to perform a marriage ceremony for my kid sister. I had planned to write off the plane ticket as a business expense, hoping the IRS wouldn't have the manpower to send someone over to wring the truth from me when it came tax time. I revealed none of this to Ed because it seemed unimportant. "Do you want me to pray, Ed?" I asked. I'd never prayed for myself and had doubts I could do a decent job for others, but it was the perfect time to try. "Oh, you can throw in some prayers," Ed said. "Praying is just another way of focusing, Ike. Every breath you take is a prayer, as a matter of fact. Breathing is about the best prayer you got going for you. What I might need for you to do is to sell an idea for me, Ike. I might ask you to try and make the passengers believe in themselves. You'll have to tell them on life, leprechauns and Tinkerbell dust, but first I'm going to have to sell you." Ed Burke was not exactly Elmer Gantry, but he was close. He rolled and paused armadillo-like over the cocktail table as he recounted his life towards me. He had been a tail gunner in the Korean conflict, and after the war had gotten heavily involved in Amway. Free of that, he had concerned himself with what he called freelance speculation, and one of the fruits of that speculation was the program he sold the airline, a program called Focus. He also sold me. I took the canvas duffel bag he offered, returned to my seat, and waited. As it stood, the plane couldn't be landed safely, but it could still be brought down in a sort of final slide for life if we could make it to a clear strip. If additional damage occurred, I was clear to initiate Focus, and the plane was clear to crash and burn. I remained calmly displaced, one foot firmly planted on the vibrating cabin floor and the other stepping through life's golden door. Two young internists en route to a mountain climb were busy ministering to the passengers, handing out their best bluffs, dodges, and tranquilizers. "Stranger things have happened," I could hear them responding to questions regarding our collective future. "There's always a chance," they would say. Of course they were right. At least Ed Burke thought so, and I agreed. Until you are nothing more than a mottled smear across some charred section of real estate, there is always hope. What people facing death needed, Ed said, was focus. When people in similar situations did focus, they were almost always trying to see through to the other side, like martyrs can focus, and adrenaline-fortified soldiers and stiff upper-lipped quartets playing Brahms on the deck of the Titanic. But that was not what Ed Burke was after. The behemoth, heavier-than-air ship, gimped along for another 30 minutes before the engine towards the end of the right wing sputtered off and another segment of the wing tore away. The plane went into a moderate spin as it entered the middle reaches of the baleful whirlpool surrounding it. We wouldn't be landing that day. In 2 or 3 minutes, Ed Burke and his co-pilot would lose the last fall to the machine, and we would all be pinned to the walls and floors and ceilings as the spinning accelerated into a dervish dance that would tear the plane apart before it hit the ground. Reanimated by their mutual fear, the rolling moans of the passengers filled the cabin. "Ladies and gentlemen," Ed Burke's voice boomed from the speakers, "it's time to focus." Same inflection, same timbre as the voice that says, "Gentlemen, start your engines." "Ladies and gentlemen, this plane is going down fast," Captain Burke went on. That comment seemed to sever the vocal cords of the passengers, and only the sounds of the slashing winds were heard, that and the yodeling death throes of the overworked engines. The stewardess, who had introduced herself as Marlene, turned in her seat at the front of the cabin and motioned me forward with a bullhorn I was to use. Marlene had been apprised of Project Focus. I clawed my way to the front, fighting the dizziness and nausea. Captain Ed was still talking. "We have no chance, my friends, and so you have nothing to lose. In approximately 2 minutes, you will have an opportunity to make history and maybe, just maybe, save your lives. I would ask you now to give your attention to the guides stationed in both the first and second class sections. Those of you that choose to participate will follow their instructions." Ed switched off then. No time for lengthy goodbyes or worthless official apologies. He hadn't mentioned to me that I had a counterpart in first class. I wondered how he or she might be doing. I nodded to Marlene, and she began to unzip the duffel bag. There was not enough time or space between ourselves and the ground for preamble. The matching sets of wings in the bag were fashioned from thick styrofoam. They were barely wider than the arms they would cover, so that the wind would not rip them from their Velcro fastenings. They reminded me of skinny versions of what a child might wear in a Christmas pageant. Along the tops, the avian details had been feathered in with acrylics. There was laughter as Marlene pulled the wings from the bag, genuine cartoon ha-haing, resonant with rapture, with paradox, a good sign. I switched on the bullhorn. "If you've ever wanted to try and fly, now is the time. Remember now your childhood dreams, dreams of skimming the clouds, then landing on the rooftops and playgrounds of your hometown." I felt I was no longer a man of flesh and blood, no corporeal plug of mass and volume, but an ephemeral creature of myth and madness, a chimera, and make no mistake, I was raving mad. I thought I could fly. A potbelly with zombie eyes had left his seat and was lurching malevolently towards me. He had taken my suggestion to be the final insult and was intent on killing me before he died, one of those types who doesn't cotton to newfangled ideas. But I was a titan then, an archetypical oarsman of the brain warp, and I simply grabbed his bulky frame with one hand as he moved towards me in slow motion and threw him across the cockpit. I looked around the cabin, surveying the faces of the dead. Most of them shone with the proud courage it takes to accept the worst, but here and there was the humbler aspect of one who still dared hope for the best. Those were the flyers, those urine-soaked fantasists who were making their way down the aisle and strapping on their wings. "I can fly," they would shout as they left their seats, and soon all of us that would fly were chanting, "We can fly," drowning out the lugubrious echoes of the faltering engines. Marlene fitted me with wings, and I could feel their quilled ends commingling with the long, hollow bones and spare flesh of my arms. I looked at Marlene, and she was a Valkyrie with eyes deep and etched as Icelandic fjords. "I can fly, I can fly," she sang as she moved her arms up and down. I fell in love with her then. I popped open the emergency exit as easily as flipping the top off a beer can, and six of us tumbled out together. We landed less than a mile from the highway in open Arizona desert. From a distance, we watched the jet plummet like a 10-cent balsa glider without a tail wing, hunks of it tearing off as it approached the ground. Then it exploded in a torrid theater of red and black jet fuel. According to the newspapers, there were no survivors. The six of us told our story. One of the young doctors and I had broken our legs in the landing. Not bad, considering we tumbled roughly 10,000 feet. We showed them our Blaken legs in the hospital, but The authorities and media only shook their heads at our wounds and clucked their tongues, saying it was unconscionable that we would go to such lengths to support such a cruel and tasteless hoax. How we got onto the passenger list, they didn't know. Why a seasoned attendant, such as Marlene, would go along with the scam, they were at a loss to understand. The airline staunchly denied the existence of my lunatic program called Focus, and indeed, in retrospect, I suspect it might have been the brainchild of one man, Ed Burke. Ed stayed with his plane that day, perhaps feeling he could fly the craft without wings if he could focus. And if that's the case, then I am somewhat surprised he didn't make it. No one in first class appeared to attempt to fly. Who knows? We stuck to our story for a long time. The weasel woman, whose name was Edna, shrieked until she lost her voice. And the fox hunting gentleman, whose name was Edgar Stone, explained over and over in a dignified paternal voice what we had done when we claimed that his arm was indeed broken at the time, but that flying could still obviously be accompanied with a broken arm. The two internists gave up mountain climbing, saying it no longer offered a challenge to them. We showed them our wings and flapped them and flapped them until they were confiscated by the court and we were all sent to psychiatric hospitals. After our release, Marlene and I were married. We spent several years together trying to fly. We remade the wings and spent weekends running off high dives and lake cliffs, but we never flew again. And that is understandable, since we are no longer within spitting distance of death. We could, of course, go up in a plane and jump out, but that would be cheating. And I have a feeling it wouldn't work. You see, dying in an airplane crash is a tragic but accepted way to go, whereas jumping from a jet with foam wingettes would seem to be a decidedly unnatural means of exiting this life. But if you're ever up near the lower levels of outer space in a jumbo jet and the wings start to fall off, you might try flying. This is Laura Waterman, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona, reading science fiction.